Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other concerning infectious diseases. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
The big topic on our minds, and this has come through in a few letters from listeners as well, is the alert that came out yesterday from the Texas Department of State Health Services. That they have caught a human case of bird flu, H5N1, in a farm worker who was working with cows that were presumed to be infected with the bird flu virus. Cases in cows have now been reported in Texas, Idaho, Michigan, Ohio, and New Mexico, raising concern that it may be passing not from birds to cows, but from cow to cow. And now, possibly, at least in this case, from cow to person. There are a couple people out there ringing alarm bells, talking about how the government should spring into action. How concerned should we be?
Well, influenza always concerns us because of how many people on a fairly regular basis die from this. On even a good year from influenza, around 15,000 to 30,000 Americans lose their lives. So we should absolutely be concerned. But how concerned is really the question that you're asking. And I think we need to have some perspective on this. We've known about this particular influenza strain, H5N1, now for well over 20 years. And it's on many, many occasions devastated fowl, both domestic birds as well as birds, wild birds, and it's spread around the globe. And we've been dealing with this, as I said, since the really early to mid-90s. We've seen this H5N1 show its ability to infect other animals besides birds, and multiple mammals have been infected with it. And some mammals have been seriously ill and some have died from it. What we're talking about now and what you're bringing to everyone's attention is that for the first time we've seen it in the United States in cows. What we know about it is that this avian influenza, which is we're calling the H5N1, avian influenza, it looks like it's the same organism in birds that is transferred to cows and infected cows, which means that there must be some receptor sites on cow cells that can get infected by avian influenza. So the virus has changed in its ability to infect cows as another mammal. We also know that these cows that have been infected, there's good epidemiologic evidence that they've infected each other because it's occurred, as you pointed out, Brian, in multiple herds around the country. So it's transmitted from birds to cows, and now it's shown its ability to transfer from cows to other cows. And finally, as you pointed out, we have a case now of where the virus has transmitted from a cow to a human. We have very good evidence for that because the human being who contracted this virus was working with the cows. And it appears to be the identical virus. So what all this is about is what we call the avian influenza. Can it become humanized? That is, can it figure out a way to infect another mammalian organism, and that is human beings, in a way that it can transfer to mammalian organisms and then from human to human? Now, we haven't seen other cases human to human of avian influenza, but it's very early in the game and we're quickly looking at that question. How sick was this person who got the avian influenza? Not very sick at all. He had some conjunctivitis, a little inflammation in his eye. So will this virus be able to become more virulent for humans? That is, not only infect humans and pass from human to human, but can it make us more sick? These are still question marks at this time.
So to clarify the nature of the question mark, it doesn't appear that in its present form, the virus is capable of racing through the human population like wildfire. But if it has already evolved to be capable of spreading from cow to cow, and in at least one case, from cow to person, it might not be that many mutations away from being capable of spreading from person to person at a rate high enough to show exponential growth.
That's absolutely right. And that's the pithy way of answering your question, and that is, how concerned should we be? I think that, to put this in perspective, unless we see that this virus transmits with alacrity from person to person, and unless we see that this virus can make people really sick like influenza can, there's very little worry. There's also really no worry that this virus is going to pass from cows into their milk and into the human population. And the reason for that is, number one, any of the cows that have been documented to be sick, they're not producing a normal amount of or a correct amount of milk. And not only that, but we pasteurize all of our milk, and pasteurization easily kills influenza virus. Just as an aside, Brian, this is another good argument for never drinking unpasteurized milk. One of the many arguments for never drinking unpasteurized milk.
Okay, point taken. I was reading a column by Zeynep Tufekci in the New York Times this morning, who tossed out, and this shocked me, a possible 50% mortality rate from avian flu in people. And as you said, the one human case that's been documented now is just showing mild conjunctivitis. His eyes are red. What is the source of the alarm bells about a much higher mortality rate?
Yeah, the source is very weak. People have become infected with H5N1. Over 900 people have died in the last 25 or so years from this. That's a very small number, considering how many. That means a larger number has, of course, been infected. When we have very, very small numbers in terms of mortality, it's very hard to derive a mortality rate. So if you have 10 people get infected with COVID, for example, early on in the pandemic, and two or three of them die, you have a 20 or 30% mortality rate. So we have seen, with several cases of avian influenza over the last 25 years, a small number of people got infected and half of them died in a couple of studies. So that would be the 50% mortality rate. We've always see when a new pandemic virus, or bacterium for that matter, hits the human population, the mortality rates always look very, very high, because those are the cases that get initially reported. And then as we learn more about it, we learn that the mortality rates are much lower. We've seen that, for example, with COVID. 4 years ago, the mortality rates looked many percentage points higher than they really are. So I would say that I wouldn't pay much attention to this 50% mortality rate. That said, as you pointed out earlier, we always worry about influenza becoming more virulent.
So with the prospect of any problem that has an exponential growth curve, the earlier you intervene, the better, the less costly. Is there a case for, like, quarantining infected cow herds, culling them, ramping up production of the vaccine that's already been developed for H5N1?
I think we'll be able to answer that question much better in less than a week. There's a tremendous amount of investigation going on now in terms of trying to understand this better, not only the situation in cows, but the situation with the virus itself. And I think within a week, we're going to have a much better answer to the question of how aggressive do we need to be to control this.
All right. At this point, I should open our phone lines. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. He's here to answer your questions about bird flu or COVID. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. 1-800-958-9008 to phone in a question. Since we've already addressed most of the questions that came into our inbox about the news on avian flu, let me get to some of the questions that we've had pending about COVID. Someone who did not sign their name at the bottom asked, is anyone looking into the long-term effects of COVID-19 infection in children who did not develop the most serious condition associated with it, MISC-C?
Absolutely. The children who developed multisystem inflammatory syndrome, MISC, in children, they are certainly being followed in terms of how they are doing over time. The good news is that those children that got over this inflammatory process, which is really a miserable inflammatory event that occurs in these kids, those children that get over it, the vast majority are fine. It can do some damage to the body, and that damage can be long-lasting. But fortunately, we're not seeing any surprises 6 months or a year or 2 years later in terms of the children who had MISC-C. So I think the answer to the question is that it is a bad syndrome. It can cause damage to the body, but we're not seeing anything happen months or years later.
All right. Our phone lines are filling up quickly, so let's start to take some callers before we go to more emails. First up is Kangs, who is in Richmond. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. And thank you for the work you've been doing. First-time caller, but I've been listening since the beginning, so really appreciate you both. I'm getting over a cold. I tested negative every day, Wednesday through Sunday, and do you think I still need to test today? Yesterday I started to feel a little better for the first time.
Kangs, let me ask before we ask the doctor to answer that question. What are you testing to clear yourself for? Like, who are you afraid you might pass your infection onto?
Today I'm going to be outside around working outside. With people, and probably briefly inside with people. I'll wear a mask. Doing a COVID test, is that what you mean, Ryan?
Yes. The question with testing is always why. So yes, one reason to test early in the course of disease might be to see if you're eligible for Paxlovid by confirming a case of COVID. Another might be late when you're recovering to make sure you're in the clear before you're around someone who might be much more vulnerable than you are to the infection. Dr. Swartzberg, when would you stop testing?
Well, Shay makes an interesting point. I think there's two things I want to say about that. In terms of when to stop testing, we know that early on in the course of COVID, the home test is often negative when you actually have COVID. So repeat testing is wise, like Shane has done. I think if you're consistently being negative after day 5 and your symptoms are much better, there's very little value in continuing testing. Maybe after day 6 or 7, you could argue for that. But right around that area, it's very unlikely if you've consistently tested negative that you do have COVID. The second point that tucked into Shane's question and observation is, I think, an important one, and that is there are lots of respiratory viruses going around. They always are going around. Fortunately, there are a lot less right now than they were a month ago, but we're still seeing an awful lot of people like Shane with cold symptoms that are due to other respiratory viruses. And we tend to think, well, if I don't have COVID, I can just go out and do whatever I want and don't worry about it and don't worry about other people. But the fact is that these respiratory viruses, nobody wants to get them, whether they're COVID or anything else. So being careful when you've got a cold, even if you're testing negative, means, like Shane said, wear that mask inside until you're really much better. The CDC recommends with COVID to wear it up to 10 days. If you don't have COVID, probably it's less important to wear it. But if you're going to be around vulnerable people, wear it. The second thing is, a lot of these common cold viruses, unlike COVID, can transmit with facility with your hands. So being really careful where you're putting your hands and using a lot of alcohol hand wash, or just washing your hands with soap and water even better, is important to do regardless of what you have. So those are a couple things that came to mind with Shane's observation.
And assuming that they don't want to pass on anything to their friends and coworkers, and assuming it is the common cold, like, how long is the period of concern after your symptoms are on the mend?
They're similar to COVID. The common cold virus we know can get on your hands and live on your hands for a while, and you can transmit it that way. We know that typically when your symptoms are starting to get better, which characteristically occur on day 3 to 5, maybe out to day 7, that the amount of virus you're shedding is much, much less. So after about 5 to 7 days, if you're much better, the precautions you need to take are much less.
All right. Hope that's helpful. Let's go to Santa Rosa for our next call, where Jerry is on the line. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning. Thank you. I just have a very simple question. Is it okay to wash KN95 masks?
Unfortunately, it's not okay to do that. And the reason why is that we often think of masks as just a filter, which they are, and washing it shouldn't interfere too much with a filter. But the electrostatic forces in the N95 mask, or in any mask, but especially in the N95 mask, play a major role in attracting or binding to those viruses so they can't be inhaled. And if you wash them, if you get the mask wet, you lose those electrostatic forces. So the mask becomes much less valuable. So unfortunately, Jerry, the answer is no, you can't wash it.
All right, let's take one from the inbox. Deanne wrote in from Berkeley. Hello, Dr. Swartzberg. My friend's friend, a retired doctor, told her people over 65 should get a booster every 4 months. Do you agree?
Well, the CDC says that you can get a booster if you're in a high-risk group, and being 65 or over is a high-risk group, especially 75 and over. So the CDC says you can get them up to every 4 months. We know in terms of looking at the amount of antibody people have and looking at the cases of COVID that the protection is waning after 2 to 3 months. It may actually wanes after even a month in a lot of people. So we know that it's waning, and it consistently is coming down over the next several months. After 4 months, our protection is significantly less than it was after a month. But it's still there, and it's still pretty good. So I think that for an otherwise healthy 65 or 75 or even 80-year-old person, that every 6 months is a reasonable amount of time. If you're older and you have other risk factors, then moving it up to every 4 months is not unreasonable at all. What we have seen is good protection from these vaccines in the older age group up to about 6 months in terms of preventing serious illness that requires hospitalization. So, and that's really what these vaccines are designed to do, prevent serious disease.
And then I guess there's also the question of just tailoring the timing to your own plans. If you're going to engage in a higher risk activity, like going on a long trip that's going to involve airports and airplanes and mixing with large numbers of people outside your normal social networks, if getting vaccinated 2 weeks before you go means you wait a little bit longer for a booster, then there's probably more value to getting that booster at 6 months than at 4 months and going traveling while your immunity is waning.
Boy, I absolutely agree with you, Brian. That's certainly, these are general guidelines, and you need to taper them to your circumstances.
All right. Back to the phone lines. Carolyn is on the phone in Oakland. Good morning, Carolyn.
Thank you, sir. I'm calling because I have a question relating to the proper treatment of being positive. I was identified as positive and therefore put in a special case of skilled nursing in which I did not get out of bed for 3 weeks. Now I can barely walk because my muscles are very seriously depleted in their strength. Is it possible for people to develop an exercise program suitable for people who have COVID or at least are positive, and so that they do not become debilitated? That's my question.
Sorry, Carolyn, I missed one word. What kind of program?
An exercise program suitable for people.
An exercise program, I got it, while you have an active infection. Dr. Swartzberg?
Yes. That question actually has been addressed. There's not an abundance of literature, Caroline, but there is some. We know that exercise is very good for our bodies, and it's very good for our immune system. But we also know that exercise, when you're ill, when you have a generalized inflammatory response in your body, like with COVID, is probably not the best idea. It may not be as good for you as just resting. And I think we have some data to support that. But some people take that too far and just feel that they need to just lie in bed when they've got COVID until they get well. And that's not necessary. People need to listen to their bodies. But I think what most of the studies have looked at really is vigorous exercise when you're acutely ill with an inflammatory disease like COVID. And in those circumstances, it's not a wise thing to do. When you're over it, resuming exercise is absolutely reasonable and good for you.
Dr. Swartzberg, this speaks to this kind of like pathologically binary attitude towards physical activity that we have in America, where you're like completely sedentary, sitting at a desk for 8 hours a day, and then, like working at your maximum heart rate in the gym for 45 minutes. I think if you're concerned about something like loss of muscle tone and atrophy, a gentle walk is going to do a lot of good for you without triggering some of the concerns of exercise-induced complications that you flagged, right?
Absolutely. You know, if you're admitted to the hospital for just about anything, including surgery, the first thing we want to do as soon as possible is get you up walking, get you up moving. So there's really no harm in doing that. And you're absolutely right, Brian, about a binary look at things is not wise. That there's all sorts of gradations in between.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, we'll have to leave it there for today. Apologies to everyone left hanging on the phone lines. Thank you so much for spending this time a Tuesday morning with us.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.